Welcome back to this second hour of Leading Edge Medicine. Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians. All while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
All right. And we are back.
Yes,
we are back with more Leading Edge Medicine. Dr. Michael Gilbert enjoying all of the cameras and fun electronics that we have behind the scenes today.
We have a whole new shop here.
Yes, we do.
Yes, oh, my goodness.
Along with Dr. Jerry Mixon. So
exciting.
Yes,
I should have dressed up.
Yeah, I've got we've got a brand new employee who is our digital marketing director.
Yes.
Oh.
And so her job is to work with all this stuff and cut it all up and get it on online and places
excited.
As possible.
Yeah.
Yes, so excited for that. Yes, the next step. All right, well, this is hour number two of Leading Edge Medicine, and we are continuing to talk about the eyes. We have Michael calling in from Bothell. Hi there, Michael.
Morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Welcome to Leading Edge.
Good morning. I'm 70 years old, and I was diagnosed with cataracts a couple years ago. But I have some complications that I would like to review with you and see what your responses are.
Sure.
So first of all, about 20 years ago, I was rejected for laser eye surgery because I had what he called dormant keratoconus, and my brother had keratoconus and had to have his eye surgery for it.
Okay.
So it hasn't affected me at all other than the fact that I was rejected for the eye surgery.
Sure.
But I was wondering, first of all, whether I should be concerned about that regarding cataracts.
No.
Okay.
So the careful answer is it's a matter of degrees. If you have lived your 70 years without it substantially impacting you, the highest likelihood it's locked in today. Keratoconus, whether it's, dormant, it's unlikely to awaken or arise at this age. By this time, life has locked in that tissue. So it's not likely to, it's almost certainly not going to progress. So you don't have to worry about that changing. The one thing it does impact is, depending on the degree, it influences the optics that we choose. For instance, there are certain implants that I would not choose to use with that and some that I absolutely would. We treat this all the time. The degree of the asymmetry in the cornea is what will influence how we choose the implant and how exactly that's treated. But I don't think I would have concerns for doing the surgery. Almost certainly isn't going to affect the process of the surgery itself. What it is going to affect is the exact optical outcome and influence, exclude some certain lens technologies where you need perfect corneal optics to for it to perform.
Okay, that's good to know. Second question is, I'm on Flomax, and I understand Flomax has some effect on cataract surgery. Can you please explain more?
I absolutely can. I was in the audience when the first paper was given that discovered that the group of patients where we had had enormous surgical difficulty go into surgery, and when you start the surgery, the iris is so flaccid, it's weak and fragile and floats in the eye in ways that is not true of a normal iris. We didn't know how to predict when that was going to happen. And in that presentation, they said that this is correlated with patients on tamsulosin. It's true of any of those drugs in that class. So people who are on those drugs for BPH, it influences the muscle tone in the eye. And the important part of that is it doesn't matter that you stop the drug. Once you've taken that drug, even for a relatively short, a month, there's permanent change in the tone of the iris tissue. So patient, since that time, we always ask patients because we need to be prepared for that. If we're prepared for it, then this is not a challenge surgically. But if it's, or not a major challenge, it is a small challenge, we have to just be prepared for it. And there are certain ways to.
But you don't want surprises.
Right, you don't want surprises. It used to always be a surprise.
Yeah.
Right? So now that's not the case. But I've certainly had patients who have denied having been on these drugs. And when I start the surgery, I say, huh, did you ever take? Well, there was a 1 month where I was on it, but I didn't like it, so I stopped. But we can see those changes even with a short-term exposure. Wow. Now, the degree of change will depend on the length of exposure. But just being off it for a week, a month, a year does nothing to alter that permanent change in the muscle tone of the iris. So that risk continues. So as long as the surgeon knows about it and is experienced, I would not say that's a major risk. For those people who are thinking about going on tamsulosin or one of the BPH drugs, prostatic hypertrophy drugs, it's a reasonable consideration to have your cataract surgery done early before you start the drug, right?
Sure. You might be simplifying things.
Because you decrease the risk of the cataract surgery process itself. That answer, I think as long as the doctor knows about it and is an experienced eye surgeon, then I would say it should not influence. And in fact, I don't think you're going to help by putting it off. By putting it off, I think you statistically increase the risk. So it's better to get it done now than put it off.
Well, that's
deferred
that
risk doesn't mean less
question.
Risk. I'm sorry?
I was going to say that actually relates to my next question as to good. When I should do it. Go ahead and continue your
to
response.
Me, soon, so there's the notion many patients and physicians, in fact, in a room full of physicians, asked a question about this related to eye surgery. Some would, in a different setting. What do you do with a patient who has only one eye and has cataracts? Well, in a room full of ophthalmologists, some of them would say, put that off as long as you possibly can, right? And that's not wrong, but some would say, do it as soon as there are some symptoms, because the risk-benefit of waiting, as you put it off, you have deferred risk, but the risk slightly increases. The harder, the more dense, the more energy to remove that aging lens as it gets older and older slightly increases. And so for me, I chose to have mine in my 50s, so I voted with my feet. I was in that group of ophthalmologists that says, as soon as there are significant symptoms at all, I would do that surgery so that it's the easiest surgery that can be done with the lowest risk profile rather than put off the risk and it being a greater risk. So for me, and were you my patient, I'd say if you have some symptoms now, especially with your being on the tamsulosin, I think this is a very good time. It's not early. My average patient has gone down over my practice lifetime. The average age of cataract surgery has decreased substantially. And now I have patients who are choosing, many patients have what's called RLE, and you'd have to be deaf and blind to the media not to have heard ads for it. RLE is simply cataract surgery that you're not waiting for the cataract to get bad. You're having it done early, essentially like what I did. have it in your 50s. And I have a growing percentage of patients who choose to have it in their 50s as opposed to waiting to their 60s, waiting to their 70s. And I'd sound aggressive, except that's what I chose for myself. So I can now say it without without embarrassment. It's exactly what I did and how, what I would offer to others who choose the same logic. So I think it sounds like if you have symptoms, it's probably time to do it.
Yep.
On a non-urgent basis, of course.
Yeah, so you've actually answered most of my third question. My ophthalmologist would actually recommend that I wait until I'm having severe problems from the cataracts. And I'm having some problems, particularly from looking at car lights at night. They're really blinding. And so maybe based on what you're saying, I shouldn't wait anymore.
So should is the, I'm going to take should as the active part of that question. And I think the should I did answer, that different ophthalmologists would offer you the answer at different times. And obviously, you know, it sounds like I would be in that camp that would say, when you have that, well, that affects your safety and your comfort when you're driving. You certainly meet the insurance criteria. What you just said meets any reasonable insurance criteria for covered cataract surgery.
And don't forget, you're putting other people on the highway at risk, too.
Yeah.
If at night you get blinded by their headlights, you are at risk, but so is everybody else on that highway with you.
Family, friends, etc.
Yeah, so I'd say go get it fixed before you run into one of my kids, okay?
I think the medical argument, so as I said, a room full of ophthalmologists would have different views on this, and neither is right or wrong, but I shared with you how I would approach it both for myself, as I did, and my patients. It sounds like your ophthalmologist, I don't want to call that conservative, but it is a different way of processing the same data and different priorities in the outcomes.
Okay. Well, you've answered my question, so I appreciate it.
But make sure he has a lot of experience. He or she has a lot of experience with the more complex cases like tamsulosin. We see tamsulosin patients all the time. It's part of growing up now. Mm-hmm. So thank goodness. The years of surprise are long gone.
Very good. Thank you again.
Yes, sir.
All right. Take care, sir. Bye-bye.
Thank you for the call, Michael. In case you're wanting to get in touch with Dr. Michael Gilbert at Northwest Vision Institute, I'm going to give you the phone number that you can reach Dr. Gilbert and his staff, 425-450-2020. That's 425-450-2020. All right, we're going to stay with the eyes here, Dr. Gilbert.
Yay.
We are going to go to Lakewood, and we have Mark on the line for you.
Good morning,
Hi,
Mark.
Welcome to the show, Mark.
Mark.
Hello.
Hi, Mark. Okay, well, you know what? Let's go to...
Oh, no.
Let's go to Hilmer, and hopefully Mark will call us back. Okay. Hilmer, good morning, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Hilmer. How can we help?
Good morning. Well, you know, it's the rapamycin story once again. It's everywhere now. You know, you'll go to Facebook, there's rapamycin creams. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's like, it's popping everywhere. And also metformin. I mean, it's like, yeah, welcome. I've known about this for a long time, but it looks like somebody's catching up to the benefits of these drugs. But my question, or my observation, I should say, regarding rapamycin is, I had a early on in my life, I somehow had damaged my both of my thumbnails, and for decades they've been kind of rippled. They don't look normal. They look kind of like the ridges on them. They kind of, you know, you can't even flatten them with a file.
All right.
And so I started rapamycin about a year ago, close to a year, and all of a sudden I'm noticing slowly but surely that the nails are actually flattening out. Mm-hmm. They look more and more normal as the weeks and months go by. And there's only one thing that I've changed over the last, you know, in the last year. I'm pretty consistent about what I take, what my intake is of anything. But I look, I go, could that be real? It's like,
yes.
Almost like,
yes, the
nail bed was damaged a long time ago, and now the nail bed is actually recovering.
Yes, sure. Hmm. Rapamycin, again, seems to impact virtually every aspect of the human body. We are finding consistently our older men who are on rapamycin are urinating better. They're getting, you know, prostate function is improving. Heart and lungs tend to be improving. Skin looks better. They heal better. Rapamycin overall appears to be a significant benefit for every aging organism from worms to human beings.
It's just amazing. after all those decades, and all of a sudden, there's like those cells, whatever was damaged in the nail bed.
They're functioning as though they were more youthful. Yes.
Very good.
Yeah.
And when we get back, because I think we have to take a little break here. I see she's waving her fingers in the air. So we'll take a break, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about rapamycin and its intersection with the dasatinib. Because that's the other compound that we're using a lot of in an effort to help older people function as though they were somewhat younger.
All right. Taking a quick break, and we will be back with more Leading Edge Medicine and your calls in just a moment. Stay right there. Leading Edge Medicine continues. Yes.
Oh, my.
The Dancing Raisins with
would
Marvin
Gaye. Never brought that to mind, but now now it's going to be stuck.
It's there forever now, Dr. Gilbert. Leading Edge Medicine is back. Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Michael Gilbert. And we're talking rapamycin and another big word, dasatinib. Is that right?
Dasatinib. And quercetin.
Quercetin. Okay.
So, yeah, the theories of aging... You know, what's going on? Why do we function less and less good as we live longer? And, you know, what's the difference in living a long time and getting old, which are two separate processes?
Right.
Some people are 60 going on 40, and some people are 40 going on 60.
You know?
So we're trying to figure out a lot of what is it. And when I started this clinic back in the 90s, our best understanding was that it was, in large measure, a decline in our hormone values, that the drop in the anabolic hormones, the growth factors, the ability to heal and grow and repair tissues was being impaired as all of our hormone levels were declining. And that turns out to be true, but then why are your hormone levels declining? What's going on in the testicles and the ovaries? Why does the lining of the arteries suddenly start allowing cholesterol particles that used to just go flowing along now start to penetrate the intima and get laid down in plaque? Why didn't that happen to us at 15? Why did it start at 40 and then get more and more?
Mm-hmm.
And it's turning out, or the latest theory is that much of the changes of aging that set us up for degenerative joint disease and atherosclerosis and dementia and osteoporosis and all of these other changes of aging are probably related to the accumulation of senescent cells in our tissues. Senescent cells are cells that reach the end of their expected lifespan, and instead of dying and being replaced, undergo a morphologic change in which they become elongated, flattened, the mitochondria inside have changed, and they start kicking out pro-inflammatory, anti-growth, anti-repair hormones and peptides and enzymes into our system. And when we were young, we didn't make a lot of senescent cells, and our immune systems recognized them as abnormal and got rid of them quickly. As we age, we make more and more senescent cells, and we clear them much slower. Instead of clearing them in 20 hours or so, we now clear them in 2 to 3 weeks. So the numbers build up much higher in our system. So our brains start going bad, along with our bones, our skin, our immune systems, you know. So all of these things that are causing these changes are now starting to get moved back to senescent cells. And now researchers are taking it one step further, and they're saying it's probably senescence of the mitochondria within the cells that triggers the senescence in the first place. So now we're talking about, mitochondrial autophagy and turnover. But one of the ways that we now know that polyphenols like resveratrol and spermidine and so on protect us is because they decrease the number of senescent cells we make. And one of the ways that rapamycin helps protect us is it dramatically decreases the formation of senescent cells. And so that in turn allows your immune system to get better, allows the tissues to function as though they were younger because they have fewer senescent cells. But then they say, well, then why not treat the senescent cells directly? Why not? We now have compounds that we know will kill senescent cells preferentially. And it turns out in the animal studies, treating our laboratory animals with anti-senescent medications extends lifespan and health span more than twice as long as rapamycin. We can treat elderly mice with rapamycin, and we'll get up to 15% increase in health and lifespan. But by treating those mice at the same point in life with anti-senescent cell therapy, we get 36% increase in health and lifespan. So then the question, of course, becomes how often should people be treated?
Right.
You know, I can treat a 20-month-old mouse who has an expected lifespan of 25 months, and he's now going to live 33 and 34 months. Okay. But if I treat a 70-year-old man and I lower his senescent cell load back to where it was at 35 or 40, which I can do, but then he's going to start continue accumulating senescent cells. He's not going to die as quickly as a mouse. He's going to live another 20, 30 years. And so his senescent cells are going to build up again. And at what point do we need to retreat him? And how aggressively do we need to retreat him, et cetera? And that's
so, Jerry.
That's what
I know.
We're
I'm going to ask
on.
The question, and I know it's not time to answer it. But the question that I'm sure everyone is thinking is really twofold. Two questions.
Yes.
Part of one. So the what is longevity doing for the average longevity patient? Because it continues to evolve, and I know Samara's doing for me. But I'm curious. Yes. What are you recommending for the average longevity patient? And more importantly, everyone burning wants to know
what is Jerry abusing
to himself. And those are the two questions that everyone is asking. When is he going to tell us now? Just go ahead. Thank you for the data, Jerry.
When we put this anti-senescent cell therapy together, I borrowed, that is, copied, the protocol from Mayo Clinic.
Mayo, right.
And Mayo Clinic uses a 3-day therapy each week for 3 weeks. And that reduces senescent cell load by about 70% over a 3-week period. So 9 days of therapy, 3 days each week for 3 weeks. A newer study that just came out within the last year is doing shorter, only 2 days of therapy, but doing it every other week over a 20-week period, or 24 weeks, actually. So they're doing 12 sets of 2 days, so a total of 24 days, in...
Total, higher dose. And so do you get a higher percentage of senescent cell control?
Same dose, but for only 2 days instead of three each time. So you're reducing, instead of 30%, you're reducing about 20%, but instead of doing it quarterly, which is what most of my doctors are doing. They're treating people with a 9-day course, and then they come back in about 3 months and give them a single 3-day course. Yeah. And so there is some variation in that. But I'm starting to think, based on the new studies that are being done for dementia, because the brain neurons don't turn over as fast as muscle cells. Neurons last for years and then slowly turn on. So when they're doing studies on dementia, trying to help older people's brains to function better for longer periods, they're treating lower doses but more frequently for longer periods of time to get a better impact on what's going on in the brain itself, which I think is probably one of the most important areas. I mean, right. Obviously, if your heart stops beating, it's over. You know? But if the brain don't work, the rest don't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. And so, you know, the questions are, is the dasatinib-quercetin combination that Mayo actually came up with and that everybody else is copying, is that the best combination? Are there other drugs that might work better on the heart as opposed to the skin, as opposed to the brain, as right. opposed to the whatever? So this is, again, leading edge medicine.
Right. And
this is the areas that we are doing speculation. We're making our best guesses. Lots and lots of doctors are treating themselves and their family members, but they're not treating their patients.
Correct. Yeah.
For the same reason that I've already, you know, said, we do something to hurt ourselves, that's different than if we do something stupid and hurt our patients.
Yeah.
So I am looking for people who have cognition issues for the gentler, longer-term therapy, for people that are worried about cardiovascular function and so on, the more intensive, shorter-term therapy. And so I think what we're in the process of developing for the clinic right now is fractionating depending on what the
need?
Studies are being done for.
Yeah.
Right. And then you look at where that particular patient's issues are. Because we now believe that one of the primary reasons as we age that your ovaries go bad and you stop making your female hormones, and the reason your testicles are going bad and you're stopping making the male hormones, is senescence of those organs. Mm. And should we perhaps be starting not in our 50s, 60s, and 70s, should we be starting to treat these people gently in their 30s and 40s, wow, when this accumulation is right. first starting to happen?
Lower dose from the
lower
from
dose
the start.
Right. And once more, not for patient care, but for my wife.
Of course.
Who is 30 years my junior. She's been getting the anti-senescent cell therapies and the rapamycin.
The Mayo protocol, I assume.
For years,
right,
although
yeah.
we've modified her because she is 30 years younger than
right,
me, doesn't
right.
make senescent cells as fast as I do.
Right.
So I treat her more gently. So, again, a whole lot of educated guessmanship,
yeah.
guessing by golly, because we just don't have firm numbers yet.
Yeah.
But we've got pretty good indications. And those of you who have, I ought to put some pictures of my wife up here now.
Yes, you should.
You know,
yes.
She is pushing 50 because I'm pushing 80. And
she looks,
you know,
30.
She looks 30.
She looks
totally.
Like she's in her 30s. Really?
Mm-hmm.
She has this little tiny, less than 23-inch waist, you know, with firm muscles and just runs like the wind and, you know, has virtually no wrinkles or creases anywhere that she's not supposed to have wrinkles and creases. And because we started treating her
right.
in her late 20s and early 30s using the technology.
Prevention that, rather than fixing.
Yes.
Precisely. And she has just done fabulously.
So as I'm making my notes, it's not that. It's not prevention. I'm trying to figure out how do I fix what.
Yes. You and I
what
have
time
to
and age has done.
You and I have to fix.
Right. I have fixing to do.
Yes, but, you know, and we are going to be a lot more aggressive with our fixing.
Yeah, exactly.
And since you are both a friend and a colleague and you know the risks you are taking,
that's
we
right.
can be a little more aggressive with you than on some people.
Very
so,
good.
Yes. But So, yeah, we are making changes.
Yeah. It,
you know, what we started doing several years ago when this first was cutting edge, we are now moving into
that. To me, is the most exciting part of medicine. And I know we've got to go to break, so let me just say, bring it back to the broader view. That's the exciting part that keeps me in medicine. And I, as I had one of my technicians who's in the room with me with every patient says, you know, it's interesting. You change how you treat a same disease differently every 6 months. Mm-hmm. And that's because the data changes, our technology changes, our insights into the technologies we have and have had changes.
Yes.
And if we don't change with it, we're...
And if you're... You know, one of the reasons you're on this show is you stay on the cutting edge.
Yes, the leading edge.
That's only because I want to stay. I want to last as long as Jerry.
So, I think everybody does.
Well, yeah, and you know, and Jerry wants to last as long as he can because I am one of the few 77-year-old men with a 12-year-old daughter at home.
Yes,
she was born when I was 65, and so I got a late start with this one. You know, and so I want to get her through college and graduate school, and who knows?
Very cool.
Yes, it should be. And if you are not a patient of longevity like I am, like Dr. Gilbert, like Dr. Mixon, you should be. And we're going to talk about that when we get back. That's right. And you can find out all about these things that we talk about on the show and how it can be better for you as well. We'll take a quick break and we'll be back with more and more questions for the eyes in just a moment. Stay right there.
Living on love, buying on time. Without somebody, nothing ain't worth a dime. Just like an old-fashioned storybook rhyme, living on love.
All right, and we're back. It's Leading Edge Medicine.
Variant of the Duchenne muscular dystrophy.
Okay. We're back with Leading Edge Medicine. And if you're not a patient, we invite you to become a patient of Longevity Medical Clinics. We talk about all sorts of things and you're going, I want this. I want the energy. I want to feel better as I'm aging. Come in for that free health analysis appointment. You can make your appointment online by going to lmclinic.com. We have three locations for you. Three clinics, one in Kirkland, that's our brand new clinic, just beautiful, Tacoma and Linwood. And when you come in, we'll do two things to you for free. We'll do the A1C test, that's a blood test, and then also the in-body test. And then the doctors will see what's going on, what you could be at risk for. It could be things like sexual dysfunction, dementia, cancers, heart disease, so many things that we talk about on the show, and see what we can do to make you feeling better and feeling what, Dr. Mixon?
Stronger, faster, leaner, smarter, sexier, and of course, happier.
Absolutely.
Because if you're not happy, the rest don't matter
much.
It
doesn't matter. Right. Come in, meet the staff, and see us here at Longevity Medical Clinics and see what we can do for you. Now, we also offer a larger blood panel. That test will test all sorts of things. You will get so much information, find out things you were at risk for, and the doctor will know so much more about what life has done to you and what can be done. And that one is a cost of Dr. Mixon. That's about just under $600, right? We do it in our labs.
$595. But that buys you over $2,000 worth of lab work and an hour consultation with a physician.
With the doctor.
To go over all of that, to sort through what has life done to you and what is it going to take to get you where you really want to go. And then you have a decision to make. Mm-hmm. You either have to accept continuing to go downhill, getting slower, fatter, weaker, dumber, and sexless. Or you can decide to become a patient at Longevity. And, you know, if that downhill slide is what you desire, you don't need us. You're doing just fine on your own.
Yes. But if you'd like to be biking in Belgium, like Dr. Michael Gilbert.
That's right.
And
hopefully you can do better than
that. And going on wonderful adventures and enjoying your family and your grandchildren and continuing to do what you love, then join us here at Longevity. Here is that number to call to make your appointment. You can do that right now, actually. 1-866-86-YOUNG. That's 866-86-YOUNG. You can also go online to lmclinic.com to make that very very important appointment, we want to see you here at Longevity Medical Clinics, which, of course, sponsor the show each Saturday, Leading Edge Medicine. All right, we've got more callers. Doctors, let's head. We've got Mark back now, and Mark has questions about his eyes.
Hi, Mark.
Welcome, Mark.
Yes, good morning. Appreciate you taking my call back. I have a question about the new fancier lenses that are coming out that you talked about.
Okay, sure.
If you have macular degeneration, does that limit to what you can or can't use, or what lenses would you recommend under those conditions? And the reason I'm asking, both my wife and I unfortunately have it, and we're going to probably need them pretty soon.
Okay. So you have cataracts or you have macular degeneration or both?
Both.
Okay, good. So that's not good. Not good that you have. Good that I understand. Not good that you have. Macular degeneration is a very wide continuum. Everything from subtle changes in the retina that's only detectable by your ophthalmologist looking in and seeing or scanning for it, which has no impact on your vision. So there are degrees of macular degeneration that are detectable in by exam, but have not influenced your vision at all. To those who are legally blind, even though they still have vision, it's peripheral vision and not such that they could safely drive. So there's, with that enormous range, just saying I had macular degeneration does not define what implant that I might recommend for that patient. It does influence what I do choose amongst that. Is it worth investing? If you have that more advanced form, then getting rid of the... So I know some colleagues who would say, if you have macular degeneration, the cataract doesn't matter. Well, this is naive, because that cataract patient that has macular degeneration still has vision, but it's only peripheral vision. Nonetheless, it's the only vision they have, right? And so if that peripheral vision, the only vision they have, is being degraded by the cataract, why would you not offer to help that patient? That said, we talked early in the show about astigmatism. We talked about multifocality, range of vision. If all you have is peripheral vision from severe macular degeneration, then those patients, I would choose the basic most insurance-covered implant. It'll help you, but not be a major investment beyond what insurance covers. If you still have useful vision out of that eye, and people, I would say the vast majority of my patients with some form of macular degeneration still have driver's license vision, well, in that case, I would consider any of the implants that I have, with one exception. There is one class of implant, the extended depth of focus lenses that use echelettes to create the multifocality, require the best of optics. And I mentioned that when the patient said, I have a weak form of keratoconus. Well, then that one technology, but it still leaves a number of technologies which do not depend on the perfection of the macula, perfection of the cornea, to give you some benefit, and it still may be advantageous to invest in those. So I don't think I've answered your question exactly, but to say that depending on the degree of macular degeneration, you can tell me what you got, and I can be more specific. But there are some I would exclude, but not very many. So how bad's the macular degeneration? Do you just take some vitamins for it? Is anyone to the point where they're getting injections? Where are you?
Well, on mine, I've had it for maybe a couple of years or so, and I can still
drive.
How
does it affect you?
See, well, when they told the way it was affected, when the doctor said, guess what, you have, and I really didn't know it. I've had.
So when you look at a picket fence or window blinds or say a sheet of graph paper with one eye, is it distorted?
No.
So you're
so
in
right
that
now,
first.
No, I was just going to say right now it's other than I think other things, like, for example, I can tell that my vision is darkening a little bit, but I don't believe it's related to macular degeneration.
Okay.
But none
so
of,
what you've described is most likely that earliest form where it's detectable in exam but has not yet influenced your vision. So you want to take every precaution, and mostly that's nutrition. But the restrictions in terms of implant technology, some would say none. I would say if you have those structural changes in the macula, it can predict increased risk of some influence in your vision long term. So I would, there is one class of those implants that I would exclude, but I would still give you certainly even the toric lenses, the enhanced range of focus lenses, are still very good for that situation. And for those who are listening and want to say, I wonder if I have some macular degeneration, I think the best home test is to take a piece of graph paper and put a little dot in the center with your best reading prescription, your reading glasses or bifocal. Look at that. Cover one eye. You have to use just one eye at a time. And if all the lines are straight, then that graph paper is being projected onto the macula. And that's a reasonable home screening for whether or not there's macular changes. If that's all straight, then it's good to get an annual eye exam to check that once you're past 50. But the likelihood of structural changes that influence your vision is way down.
The question is he on the AREDS too?
Yeah. So now we skip from what implant do I choose? Although if you ask me for a name, I can tell you the one I would probably recommend for you. Were you my patient? I know what I would choose today for myself in that situation, an enhanced monofocal lens. And that would help me both today and in the future and give you slightly better vision than the implant that we did at the top of the line for Dr. Mixon years ago. So the answer is that for those who have, I'm sure your doctor has mentioned the AREDS study suggests that micronutrients can influence the statistical risk of progressing to loss of vision from your stage. So the most commonly available, the one used by the NIH study, is called PreserVision. And that PreserVision is taken two times a day. They're two little capsules. Later, that AREDS study was done by the NIH. It was repeated by the NIH. It's very powerful, nationwide, high numbers, very reliable. So I would absolutely take that. That data has been analyzed retrospectively, and a couple of years ago, they had the 10-year review of the data. And since that time, some insights have come out. And there's some more recent studies that show that most likely omega-3s also are helpful in decreasing progression of macular degeneration. Nobody's got a dose for that. The studies have all been qualitative rather than quantitative, but suggest that if patients are on omega-3s, that there's a decreased progression to loss of vision. One that just was published, or actually in print, I think now, that I'm looking forward to seeing, is also unfortunately qualitative, but high numbers, 4,000 patients, patients who are on metformin in this group of 4,000, whether in the decade of your 50s, 60s, or 70s, each of those had a very high percentage decrease in macular degeneration progression. So there's obviously much more that needs to be said about that. I'm not saying everyone ought to go out and take metformin, but that was fascinating and asked us to look more carefully at that. So metformin, again, no dose was ever mentioned. So that means the study just looked at, were you on it?
Or not.
Or not, right? And it's a retrospective study. They don't look at what dose you're on. It's hard to do that. That's a more involved research. But high number of patients, and they looked at by decade, and every decade of patients for 50s, 60s, 70s showed a significant level of less progression to macular, visually significant macular degeneration if you're on metformin. Sorry, I hope I said melatonin. Did I say metformin?
You said metformin.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Not metformin.
Melatonin.
That helps you live longer.
Yes.
Let me be real clear. I meant to say melatonin, okay? Which is completely, completely different, right? But no doses offered. So I would personally be on AREDS 2 I'd have some omega-3s, and we're speculative about what that dose might be, so we can all argue that there's no data that helps with that, but omega-3s of some kind. And I'd, if there's no reason not to, a little metformin.
Melatonin.
Did I say it again?
You said metformin.
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm going to get fired here.
No.
Don't pick up metformin, because that's that's by prescription only. Melatonin is over the counter.
Yes.
And Dr. Mixon can suggest doses.
Okay.
The dose range of that is very wide, but at least
certainly
taking
is.
Some allows you to check the box.
Now, what about my in regards to my wife? Hers is more advanced than mine.
Okay.
And in other words, when she looks at someone, it's hard to. She says she sees a black spot.
Yes.
And it's again more advanced than mine. What about in the situation of what she has?
So, I'm not sure exactly what you're asking. I'm going to answer it in two ways, because we've been talked about nutritional benefit. So I will tell you that just recently there was a publication that was looking at the AREDS vitamins being helpful to slow progression when you do have some geographic atrophy, which is what it sounds like. So there's been a question that really hasn't been answered before this, is once you have it, is it still worth taking the, quote, prophylaxis of AREDS 2? And this is saying, yes, looking at, again, the AREDS data, now more than a decade old, do those patients who have it progress more slowly if you're on the AREDS 2? Answer is yes. So she should be on the same nutrition. Now, I think maybe the reason for your call was, what implant would I choose? And again, depending on the degree of, I think I partially answered that earlier, is to say the more severe the central vision loss, the less she's going to benefit from the higher cost premium lenses. Now, if she has a high degree of astigmatism, then I'd still use the toric lens. A smaller degree, like the patient who called earlier who said she had 1.5 diopters of astigmatism, I would absolutely treat that in a fully, someone with full macular capability. For your wife who has lost some of that, then it would only be higher degrees of astigmatism where I'd argue there would be value in that. So it really depends on her situation and her prescription, but that would influence what implant I choose.
I'd also be looking, though, at the degree of cataract.
Oh, yeah.
Because if she's got, as I did, the yellowing of the lens,
yes,
so that you're wearing effectively sunglasses 24 hours a day, you're decreasing the amount of light getting through to the macula and to the peripheral vision.
Right.
And so fixing the cataracts and getting her nice clear lenses to get all the light possible through.
It speaks to what I was saying. You're exactly right. In my view, those patients who some ophthalmologists would put off because they have macular degeneration are missing the daily function of that individual. The only vision they have is in the periphery.
Sure.
If it's being degraded by the cataract, get that the heck out of the way so they have the best that they can possibly have.
Yep.
So I still think that cataract surgery is of value for her. If she has significant cataract, sounds like she does. That darkness is probably exactly that.
That's what it sounds like.
And I think getting the cataract surgery for her is probably much more important than exactly what lens. If she had high astigmatism, then a premium lens might be of some value, but it would really depend on her total prescription, whether that would be of value. She would have a little bit higher threshold, but still value of the cataract surgery. I have many such patients.
Yeah. Okay. Hope that helps.
So there's still lenses out there. Yes.
Absolutely.
So there are lenses out there that will be a benefit, I guess is what I might say, and that you can use.
If I had her degree of macular degeneration, it would not dissuade me a moment for having cataract surgery. I just wouldn't, it would influence what implant that I choose.
Sure. But, the key here is to get a completely crystal clear lens that lets in all the light that can get in. And that's, that's going to give her the best residual vision she's going to get.
Exactly.
Okay. Great. Well, I thank you very much for
let us know how we can help.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks again.
Thank you for the call, sir.
Yes, sir. Bye-bye.
Thank you for the call very much. And we have time for one more call, doctors. From Camano Island, M is on the line.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question. I was told I have Fuchs dystrophy, F-U-C-H-S.
Yes, ma'am.
And I was wondering, what is there anything that can be done about that? And also, I was told I am due for a cataract surgery, and that would be kind of a negative effect on the Fuchs dystrophy.
Sure. So what is Fuchs dystrophy? Fuchs dystrophy is a dystrophy. It means you were born with it. Is a defect in the endothelial cells of the cornea. That defect means those cells are fewer in number and weaker. The problem with those are that you are born with one set and that's all you get. They don't replace or reproduce. If they are damaged, they can be surgically replaced, which is a surgery if they're failing. So what's their job? Their job is unique in the body. They are pump cells. So the tissue of the cornea is compressed collagen, unique in the body. There are no blood vessels going through it, but it maintains its clarity by that single layer of cells pumping the fluid, the water, out of that tissue so it remains highly compact. When it's highly compact, it's clear. If those cells aren't able to do their job, if they're weak, then the pump decreases and fluid starts to accumulate in the cornea.
And you get edema.
And you're looking at edema, or you're looking through edema, which in the earliest stages looks like a fog. You're looking through fluid that is like a fog. It is foggy vision, and that's swelling of that cornea. So early stage of Fuchs has no impact on your vision, and many live their lives without any impact in their vision at all. It can progress on its own just by age. We know of nothing to slow it down or influence it, so we largely just treat it when it becomes a problem. So when can it become a problem? Well, on its own, it can progress to the point where the cornea no longer is pumping itself clear, and you start to have that foggy vision. So there are some things you can do over the counter, and there's a glaucoma drug that incidentally, you know, not FDA approved for this, but incidentally, there's one glaucoma drug that nudges these cells just a little bit. So we can put off surgery for that a little. And this is not widely used, but something that struck me that, you know, oh my, that has to be used in my cornea practice. So we take advantage of that. That's not widely published, but it's known. But that failure of that cells can be accelerated by cataract surgery. When you go into the eye, fluid is flowing past those cells, and there's normal, even in the most perfect surgery, there's going to be a percentage loss of those cells. The normal cornea would not suffer at all, or may have a little swelling, just like you'd have a little swelling in your knee if you had knee surgery, but then it recovers. But if you have Fuchs dystrophy, those are weakened cells and fewer in number. Consequently, their margin for that critical level of performance to keep your vision clear can be breached. So sometimes, although I do many Fuchs dystrophy patients, we do it a little differently, but many patients have no problem afterward. But it does. Okay. It is that increased risk they're talking about. Now, it's interesting, we were talking earlier in the program, when you're at risk for a surgery, do you just put off the risk? Well, this is exactly the kind of patient where putting off that risk is going to increase the risk. So there, it's a delicate balance. Do I take the risk early and at a lower level? Because removing a lesser cataract takes less energy. If it takes less energy, there's less stress on those friable cells. Then if we wait, we put off the risk, but now the risk is slightly higher because it takes more energy to remove that harder cataract. And you're more likely to have the complication of loss of that of the cornea. So if that happens, what do you do? Oftentimes it'll bounce back, but very slowly. If it doesn't recover, then you're left with a transplant. Fortunately, the transplant technology on that has improved a great deal, but nonetheless, if it can be prevented by precautions in surgery, someone who knows how to protect against Fuchs dystrophy damage, or by doing it early enough that it's less of a problem, then you're better protected. Does that all make sense?
I was told, that maybe laser would be better, a laser-assisted cataract surgery.
LASIK?
That's what my...
Laser-assisted cataract surgery.
Oh, okay.
So I do laser-assisted cataract surgery. It's reasonable. It depends on the degree of cataract. If it's a relatively early cataract, then I don't think it adds very much. It does statistically decrease some of the energy that's used, so that could be a benefit.
Yes, you know
I have to see the eye.
Em, we're going to have to leave. We've got a hard end right here, but if you'd like to call our next show, you can stay on the line and our producer will give you that number, okay? All right, that's it for Leading Edge Medicine this week. Thank you, Dr. Michael Gilbert, and
thank you.
Also, Dr. Jerry Mixon. We will be back live in the studio again next week, right here on Leading Edge Medicine. Have a wonderful rest of your weekend, and thank you for listening.